Part 2, Chapter 7. The professor and the boys were standing in the middle of the Blandlands Plain. The waving sea of brightly colored flowers stretched ahead for miles and miles. In the distance, the Wangdoodle's palace sparkled in the early morning sunlight. The professor leaned on his umbrella and said, "Now this is the way I see it. The prox of the high behind Splintercat took Lindy away. What would he do with her? Where would he put her for safety? He wouldn't take her to the palace, because the whole point is to keep us away from the palace. My hunch is Lindy is still with the Splinter Cat." "But how do we find the Splinter Cat?" asked Ben. "I only know he lives in the mountains," replied the professor. "But it could be those mountains, or those mountains, or those." He pointed north, east, and west. Ben's heart sank. "Oh gosh, she could be anywhere. It's going to take ages to find her." "Perhaps not. Let's use our heads and work this out. The Splinter Cat is probably just like any other mountain cat. He would need a rocky terrain, with trees, perhaps a cave or two. Those mountains to the west have a forest, but it looks a bit dense. Too dark and gloomy for a Splinter Cat." "Those mountains are open and grassy," said Ben, pointing north. "Right, so I'll bet that the Splinter Cat's lair is in the east, somewhere beyond Ploy. Probably in the Gambit region. That's perfect cat territory. Come on, boys, we've got a long way to go." They walked for what seemed like hours. They grew hot and thirsty, and it was a relief to hear a soft singing sound that told them they were near a stretch of the Golden River. The boys ran to it and drank their fill of the cool, refreshing water. "Can you two swim?" the professor asked suddenly. "It occurs to me that we could reach the mountain faster if we crossed the river." "Let's do it," said Ben enthusiastically. They took off their clothes and rolled them with their shoes into tight bundles. They waded into the water and swam slowly across the river, holding the bundles above their heads. It was a fascinating swim. At every stroke, the water changed its tune, making sweet music. Once on the other side, they dressed hurriedly. Tom looked around. "You know, it's odd that the Wiffle Bird hasn't turned up." "It is odd," agreed the professor. "Of course, she may be watching out for Lindy." "She may not know we're here yet," suggested Ben. "Well, I sort of miss her company," declared Tom. "Even though she's a nuisance sometimes, it's nice having her around." Ben noticed a movement off to his left. He pointed and whispered, "I thought I saw something." They crouched on the ground and remained absolutely still. A group of fierce-looking creatures emerged from a break in the rocks and moved slowly in a line towards the Golden River. They were at least 6 or 7 feet high at the shoulder, with shaggy, caramel-colored fur and enormous, curling, sharp-pointed horns. "What are they?" gasped Thomas. "That's a herd of flummox." The professor's face was alight with excitement. "They're distant relatives of the great aurochs that roamed Europe thousands of years ago. We'd better give them a wide berth. They could be dangerous." When they finally reached the foot of the mountains, they were travel-stained and weary. Tom, trailing a few paces behind the others, noticed something small and shiny lying against a stone. "Professor!" he cried excitedly. The professor whirled in alarm. "Hush, Tom! Look! Look what I've found!" The professor examined the shining object. "Why, it's a 25-cent piece!" "It's the one I gave Lindy. I know it is. She said she would keep it in her pocket as a lucky piece. She must have dropped it, don't you see?" The professor was excited, too. "This proves we're on the right track. Lindy passed this way. What a stroke of luck." "Professor, look at this," cried Ben, and he knelt down to look closely at the ground. "It's a paw print, a really large one." "It's the Splinter Cat's, all right," confirmed the professor. He looked up and scanned the mountain towering above them. "See that plateau? I'll bet you anything that's where he went." "How are we going to get up there?" asked Ben. "There must be a way up somehow. Come on." At that moment, a great shriek rent the air. It was so loud and so close that the professor and the boys practically jumped out of their skins. Terrified, they flung themselves to the ground. Tom found his voice. "What do you suppose it is?" "Whatever it is, it's pretty big," whispered the professor. "Let's be careful." They crawled forward. A faint mist hung just above their heads, and there was a damp feeling in the air. They became aware of a heavy panting sound. Cautiously, they peered around a high wall of rock, and there, standing at the foot of the mountain, enveloped in clouds of steam, was the most remarkable train they had ever seen. It was pure white and gave the impression of being made from thick, fluffy cotton wool. Yet, the rods and wheels and couplings and the great engine itself looked strong and shone like polished steel. Written on the side of it in bold letters were the words, "The Brain Strain." The professor was staggered. I expected wonders in this credible land, but I never thought I'd see anything as wonderful as that. He looked at the mountain. Silver rails went straight up the sheer rock face and disappeared into the clouds. "If I'm not mistaken," he said, "that train goes right up to the top. That, my friends, is how we're going to reach Lindy and the Splinter Cat." "But what makes the train go?" queried Ben. "I don't see an engineer. I don't see anybody." The professor scrutinized the train intently. He mumbled to himself, "Steam, hot air, brain strain." His face suddenly brightened. "Got it," he said triumphantly. "That thing is full of hot air. Hot air rises. That's how it goes up the mountain. That's why it doesn't need an engineer." "How does it get down the mountain again?" asked Tom. "I have absolutely no idea, but come on, we've got to board that train." They started around the wall, but the professor would suddenly grab the boys and pulled them back. "Look out," he whispered tensely. "Sidewinders." Three of the horrifying creatures were emerging from the trees. They were deep in conversation. Their trunks waved in the air and their feet crunched the gravel path as they made for the train. The brain strain gave another shriek and began to puff and blow mightily. Clouds of steam belched out of the engine and rolled towards the professor and the boys. "Let's go," said the professor urgently, and he began to run. Under the protective cover of billowing steam, the boys made a dash for it. The train was beginning to move. Ben was the fastest, and he was the first to gain a foothold on the steps of the moving caboose. He turned in time to see the professor reach out and hook his umbrella onto the railing to pull himself ahead. Tom was in the rear, and to everyone's horror, he suddenly stumbled and fell. The train was gathering speed, and the boy's face took on a look of panic as he saw it pulling away from him. "Come on, Tom, come on," the professor cried. Tom scrambled to his feet and ran as hard as he had ever run in his whole life. His legs began to ache, and a desperate sob caught in his throat. The professor leaned out as far as he could. He handed one end of his umbrella to Tom. The boy grasped it tightly. Professor yanked hard, and Tom, stumbling and lurching, was hauled aboard the train, where he lay panting and gasping with relief. The professor pulled him to his feet. "Hold on, Tom. We're climbing fast." The boy gripped the railings and gave the professor a weak grin of thanks. The brain strain heaved and puffed its way up the face of the mountain. Higher and higher it climbed. They were nearing the plateau. Over the noise of the engine, the professor shouted, "It isn't going to stop. We'll have to jump." Suddenly, the train leveled off and began to gather speed at an alarming rate. "Now," yelled the professor, and the three of them leaped from the speeding train. They hit the earth hard, rolling over and over, tumbling and bouncing. Tom was flung into a bush, and the professor disappeared. Ben staggered to his feet, weaving unsteadily toward his brother. "You okay?" he gasped. Tom nodded. "Where's the professor?" "Here," came a faint reply, "over the edge." They rushed to the precipice. The professor's umbrella had caught on a root, and he was hanging on to it for dear life and swaying gently out over the wind. The boys leaned over and grabbed him. Ben clasped his wrist, and Tom caught hold of his collar. With a mighty heave, they pulled him to safety. He was deathly white and lay for several moments face down in the grass. Presently, he rolled over and gazed up at the sky. Then he looked at the boys. "Thank you both," he said simply. "That was a close call." He sat up and looked at the mountain where, high above, the brain strain came to a halt. The sidewinders got out. Then a remarkable thing happened. The train slowly vanished before their eyes. "Good Lord," the professor shook his head in disbelief. "That answers your question, Tom. The brain strain doesn't have to get down the mountain. It dissipates at the top." "How could it do that?" asked Ben. "Like any hot air that rises, it just dissipates. That accounts for all the clouds up there. I presume the train reassembles itself at the bottom of the mountain when it has gathered enough hot air. It moves up once again." "Fantastic." Tom and Ben helped him to his feet. They could see that the adventure had been quite a strain for their friend. He looked pale and not very steady, but he gazed around with interest and said, brightly enough, "Well, I wonder where we go from here."